Hello, everyone. This is Sue Garten. I'm an attorney with Greater Hartford Legal Aid, and welcome to the third Legal Services briefing call. We have been organizing these briefings to share information that can help people affected by COVID-19. We had prior briefings on benefits and education. Recordings of those are available on the Legal Services website, which is ctlawhealth.org. That website has easy-to-understand information about legal rights in many areas, both related and unrelated to COVID-19. Today, three Legal Services attorneys are going to be speaking with you about changes in the employment landscape since the pandemic began. One caveat, the information we're going to be sharing is accurate as of today, April 16th. It changes daily. So please check CT Law Help for updates. So first up today will be attorney Corrine Salim from New Haven Legal Assistance. She is going to be talking about worker rights regarding safety issues on the job. She'll be followed by attorney Nadine Nevins from Connecticut Legal Services. And Nadine will speak about the new paid sick leave and family medical leave laws. I will end with talking about the new unemployment insurance programs and the rules for those programs. So we're going to try and do this all in about 30 minutes. We'll be describing the basic provisions in all these areas, and obviously there are many details that we won't have time to cover. Thank those of you who ended up sending in questions. We hope to answer them. And after this briefing, if you have more questions, you can mail them to the email address where you RSVP'd, and one of us will respond to you. So, Corrine, would you like to begin?
Yes. Hello, everyone. My name is Corrine Salim. I'm with New Haven Legal Assistance. I was going to do a quick overview of where to find some of these worker and safety rules and then go more into workers' rights around workplace safety, which there are three big areas, federal occupational safety and health protections, which are limited in some ways in terms of enforceability, the executive order by the governor that has more enforceability, we believe, and then collective action under the National Labor Relations Act. Over the past few weeks, the Center for Disease and Control, CDC, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and the governor's office have put forth information on workplace safety during the pandemic. It covers, you know, a wide range of things, especially protective gear and physical distance measures. I'm not going to go over that, but I do want to direct everyone to the Connecticut government website. The Department of Economic and Community Development rules, which came out on safe workplace rules for essential employers, and then the CDC and OSHA guidelines, which are on those websites. The problem is that many employers are ignoring the safety of their workers. These are largely low-income and many workers of color. So we've been getting questions, for example, from grocery store workers who are afraid to go into work because, you know, their employer is not implementing the appropriate safety measures. For example, still having meetings, gatherings of people, more than five people in a close, like, physical distance. And what we've been telling folks really depends, you know, on their situation. The issue is that a lot of essential workers are afraid for their life and the safety of the families they're going home to, but they also need a paycheck, so they're fearing retaliation. And then when you add issues around documentation status, there's that even further fear of retaliation. So I'm just going to cover first federal Occupational Safety and Health Act protections. So OSHA has not issued any enforceable COVID-19 specific requirements on practices and policies that employers have to implement to protect workers. And, you know, there's been a lot of pushback and advocacy around that. They have, however, issued voluntary guidelines which we've noticed in the past, you know, week have weakened in some ways based on economic concerns and not based on workplace safety. But in terms of what we're telling workers, we're still encouraging private and federal workers to file complaints with OSHA because there's still a general obligation that employers have to provide a workplace free of recognized hazards that are causing serious physical harm or could cause serious physical harm. And then OSHA has specific standards like a sanitation standard that apply in this situation that, you know, for example, requires all restrooms be sanitary and include hot and cold running water. So what we're telling folks is that there is a complaint process online or by phone right now. It's best if the complaint details how the workplace is violating an OSHA or CDC guideline. The worker can ask for their information to be kept confidential, which I think OSHA is also required to do. But just in case, you know, a representative of the worker, like a union rep, a legal advocate, or family member can also file a complaint on their behalf. And then OSHA will go through its regular procedures in terms of finding out more information and reaching out to the employer. For state and local employees, they can go through Connecticut OSHA, which is in charge of enforcing those safety and health regulations for state and municipal employees, and that complaint process is also online through the Connecticut DOL website. There are also retaliation protections under OSHA, which prohibit employers from retaliating against employees for filing a complaint or raising a concern with their employers around safety. Workers can file a complaint if they're, for example, discriminated against, either terminated or in some other way for raising safety and health concerns. The problem is that it has to be done within 30 days of the act. And, you know, OSHA has had a really poor track record with these retaliation claims, and there's long process times for those claims. Something that we think has more enforceability right now is the governor's executive order, which stated that the Department of Economic and Community Development will issue legally binding statewide rules. And the department has posted those, which I talked about previously, on their website. And the department states that workers should contact their health department and or local authorities if there are issues with employers not following the department's rules. It's not clear, however, how those complaints will be handled. The biggest protection right now is concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act. If workers do not believe their workplace conditions are safe or healthy, we're suggesting take action with their coworkers as a group because there's power in safety in numbers. So coworkers taking action together to address workplace issues is considered under the federal act, quote, protected concerted activity, which really means that an employer cannot lawfully retaliate against workers for taking action together to keep the workplace safe. So the recommendation is that coworkers communicate with their employer, ideally in writing, in the form of gathering signatures to sign a petition that states specific demands for like a more safe and healthy workplace. There's all kinds of examples circulating right now, which I'm happy to share if anyone is interested. Workers are presenting, you know, these petitions to their boss and reminding them, you know, our health is at risk. And then we also have examples if like the employer refuses to comply with the demands of the petition, there are workers who are going, you know, a step further and gathering their coworkers to stop work or go on a strike. Just to note that we think lawyers can provide some form of cover, and like media pressure is also helpful as a protection against employer retaliation. And then just to note, and I think Sue will cover this more, but when issues around safety are brought to the employer's attention, there's, you know, a stronger case for unemployment, you know, good cause unemployment quits. But also, you know, if you're fired for retaliatory purposes, and I think Sue will cover that a little more. And then just one thing to note, that unions can be important right now in advocating for the health and safety of workers. So we're asking folks to, like, consider language in their current collective bargaining agreements. There's some really good resources out there right now. For example, Labor Notes has a steward's guide to COVID-19 that talks about, like, your union's role in all of this. I just wanted to share a few resources. There's some really good toolkits and resources out there for workers' rights and safety and organizing around that. Organizations like Arise Chicago have some organizing tools and specific petition language that workers can use. The National Employment Law Project has some really good resources on workplace safety, rights and resources. Specifically, they have an FAQ on immigrant workers' rights in COVID-19. A lot of the protections I'm talking about include workers regardless of immigration status, but obviously there's still that fear of retaliation, and that resource is very helpful. National COSH has a resource for workers. Labor Notes, like I said, has a workers' rights tool. And just to note that there are COVID-19 workers' rights information from labor unions, like the AFL-CIO, that includes tips for non-union workers. And then just to note something before I hand it off to Nadine, if you know of large private Connecticut workplaces that remain open and that are not complying with basic safety and health standards, we really want to know about it. We're trying to brainstorm what, you know, we could possibly do about that from a litigation perspective. So please reach out about that, and reach out if you have any questions, if you want, you know, a list of resources, or you want to just brainstorm. I'm going to hand it over to Nadine now to talk about paid sick leave.
Hi. I'm going to talk today about the two new paid leave laws created in response to the COVID-19 crisis. They were created under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. The first thing you should know is that these apply only to employers with fewer than 500 employees. The law went into effect April 1st, and it only goes until the end of the year. And unlike unemployment insurance, where you apply to the Connecticut Department of Labor, you don't apply to the Connecticut Department of Labor to take leave under these two acts. People are going to have to talk to their employers to see if they're eligible, and they get paid by their employer. And enforcement of these laws is by the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. So don't call the Connecticut Department of Labor. They are not enforcing these laws. I'm going to start with the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, which allows employees to take 2 weeks paid sick leave when they can't work or telework because of the following reason. So you can take 2 weeks paid sick leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act if they're subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19. So this includes orders to stay home and government advice to categories of citizens to stay home, like those who have compromised immune systems or asthma or are of advanced age. So those people, they can take leave. If an employee has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine or if they're, again, in this particularly vulnerable position because of their age or other illness, then you can take leave. And if you are in this category of people who are particularly vulnerable, you may not even have the virus itself, but you still should be able to get paid sick leave under this Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And of course, people who are experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 and are seeking medical diagnosis and treatment, they can take leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And it's not enough just to claim you have the symptoms under this reason for taking leave. You have to actually be seeking medical diagnosis. And that doesn't mean you have to have tested positive, but you have to have for COVID-19, but you do have to be seeking medical diagnosis and treatment. Another reason you can take leave under this Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act is if you're caring for somebody else who is subject to a quarantine or isolation order or has been advised to self-quarantine. So with somebody that you have a personal relationship, an immediate family member, a person who regularly lives with you, it does not have to be a blood relative, but it's generally somebody who'd be taking care of you if the tables were turned. Then the big category that's different from other leaves in the past is that a worker who is caring for a child because the school's child is closed or because the daycare is closed or the child care provider is unavailable because of COVID-19, you can get leave to take care of your child who is under 18. And the child can be over 18 if, due to mental or physical disability, they're incapable of self-care. So it's important to know what reason the person is taking leave for, because they get different amounts of money depending upon why they're taking leave. So if a person is taking leave because of a quarantine or isolation order from the government or some government entity, self-quarantine recommendation, or experiencing symptoms and seeking treatment, those people are going to be eligible for their regular rate of pay up to a cap of $511 per day, and in total a maximum of $5,110 to take leave for those reasons. If they're taking leave to care for somebody else or to care for their child because their school is closed or the daycare is closed, and they get paid two-thirds of their regular salary, capped at $2,000 per day and $2,000 in the aggregate. People who are working part-time get prorated amounts based on the average number of hours worked over a two-week period. These amounts can't be carried over into the new year. People are not going to get them upon termination. But something to note about this is that these new sick leave amounts are in addition to and not in lieu of other paid leave they may have. So if their employer has paid sick leave benefits, they'll get that in addition to taking these new federal leave. But employers must allow employees to use the COVID-19 related sick leave before any other sick leave. Employers are entitled to their jobs back or an equivalent position once they get back to work. However, employers who have fewer than 25 employees don't have to restore a worker back to their former job if the position no longer exists because of economic conditions or other changes in the business due to the public health emergency. But they do have to, for 1 year, let that person know if any equivalent position becomes available and give them that job if it does within the year. Employers can't require employees to find their replacement to cover hours when they're using leave. Employers said, sure, you can have leave. You can find somebody to do your job. They can't do that. Employers also have to post a notice related to this section in a conspicuous place in the workplace, and that was supposed to have been done April 1st. And because a lot of people are not working in their office, employers were supposed to do this in a way most, you know, likely to get to their workers. So it could have been by mail, could have been by email. And I do have a concern that people don't know about these and won't know about the leave provisions. But if a worker needs additional leave at the end of 2 weeks, they can take leave under the Emergency Family Medical Leave expansion. So they can take up to 12 weeks of the expansion when they're unable to work or telework because, again, they have a child, they have to care for a child who's not in school or in child care because of the coronavirus. And employees must have worked for at least 30 days to be eligible for this expanded leave. There was no such requirement for the emergency paid sick leave. You work 1 day, you're eligible for those 2 weeks if you meet one of the reasons listed. But employees have to have worked at least 30 days to be eligible to use the expanded FMLA. The first 10 days or 2 weeks of the expansion is unpaid, you know, but they can fill in those 2 weeks under the paid sick leave provisions and so get paid for that. And they can add whatever approved vacation, personal leave, or sick leave they have to get full pay. But after the 10 days are exhausted, employees must pay their employee two-thirds of the employee's regular rate of pay, capped at $200 per day and $10,000 over the entire 12 weeks. So those are the two programs. There are some serious exemptions that I want to tell you about. Employers with fewer than 50 employees may be able to get an exemption from having to pay sick leave or expanded family and medical leave to care for a child whose school or daycare is closed, if doing so would jeopardize the viability of the business. And there are regulations that define what jeopardizing the viability of the business is. The interesting thing about that is that employers can self-determine their eligibility for the exemption. They don't have to certify with the Department of Labor or anybody else that they meet the standards, and they don't have to provide any documentation. They just have to retain records for their own file. So this seems like a lot of people work for smaller employers who sounds like they'll easily get exemptions and won't have to provide the leave. Another big exemption is for healthcare providers and emergency responders. They're excluded from leave under these provisions. The definition of healthcare providers is ridiculously broad, including, for example, any individual employed by a company that contracts with a hospital or healthcare center, a medical school, a local health department, a nursing facility, or anyone employed by a company that produces medical products. So this would exclude somebody working at a factory that happens to be making any kind of medical equipment or even a hospital janitor. This exclusion alone takes benefits away from an estimated 9 million healthcare workers or emergency responders, many of whom are low-wage workers who not only need to get paid sick time, but really need to stay home rather than spread the virus where they work. Another important note is people cannot get benefits. They can't get UI benefits and leave benefits at the same time. And nor can employees get leave if their employer has shut down or there's no work available. In those circumstances, they're going to have to apply for unemployment compensation. And I guess on the good news side is that once they exhaust their leave, there is eligibility for unpaid leave under the Connecticut FMLA. And employees who work for an employer that employs 75 or more people who have worked 1,000 hours in the past year are eligible to take 16 weeks of leave in a 24-month period. But note that under the Connecticut FMLA, you can't take that leave to care for a child whose school or daycare is closed due to the coronavirus. So that was really fast. I am concerned that people won't know about these provisions, so please spread the word. And I'm now going to mute myself so that Sue Garten can fill us in on unemployment compensation.
Thank you, Nadine. So I'm now going to talk about the options available for people who aren't going to work. And I'm going to use the phrase UI, by which I mean unemployment insurance. So there is good news, which is that with the new programs, many more people can get UI than before. There is going to be more money for them than before, and they'll be able to collect UI for more weeks than they have before. And then there was more good news as of yesterday, which is that due to computer programming changes at the Connecticut Department of Labor, the processing time for an application has been reduced from 6 weeks to what they expect to be 1 week by next week. So that will help the money flow into people's pockets much more quickly. I'm going to start by talking about when UI is not available, and Nadine talked a little bit about this. If someone is on paid sick leave or paid family and medical leave, they can't also collect UI. If someone can safely work at their worker's location, they probably can't collect. If they can telework, they can't collect. It's really for people who are not able to work or work safely. Most undocumented workers are not eligible for UI. There are limited exceptions. People with DACA status and others who've been granted work authorization by the U.S. Immigration Service, they can be eligible for UI. One of you sent in a question about a client with a U visa who was concerned about the public charge implications of accepting UI benefits. UI benefits are not going to be counted for public charge determinations because they are not a means-tested benefit. So first I'm going to talk about regular traditional UI for workers who lost their job through no fault of their own. These are workers who have an employer and generally are given a W-2. They may now qualify if they're not working because of COVID-19. So if they were furloughed, if they were laid off, if they're self-quarantining, if they're home caring for children whose school or daycare has closed, they are likely eligible for regular UI. And they can get partial UI benefits if they're still working but their hours were reduced. Also, and Corrine alluded to this, if the working conditions at the job are endangering the worker's health and the worker asks the employer to fix the problem, but the employer can't or won't fix the problem, the worker, if he or she leaves the job, will likely qualify for UI. So an example might be, and we had a case coming in like this, a worker had asthma. The worker had a job that required a lot of public contact, and the employer wouldn't allow the worker to use a mask or gloves. That worker could leave that job, and because the job was a danger to his or her health, likely qualify for UI. The weekly UI benefit depends on how much the worker earned. And the earnings period that the Department of Labor will look at is the two highest earning quarters for calendar year 2019 if someone applies in April. The average weekly UI benefit in Connecticut is $403, and the most someone can collect in a week is $649 plus $15 a week for each dependent. And many of you probably heard about the new federal program, which will give each UI recipient an additional $600 a week. That program is called the Pandemic Unemployment Compensation, or PUC program. Those benefits can be paid to workers who collect UI between March 27th and July 31st. In Connecticut, it will become available next week, April 24th, according to the Department of Labor, and it can be retroactive to March 27th. That extra $600 a week is not counted as income for either SNAP, food stamp benefits, or for Husky medical coverage. So regular UI is 26 weeks, and now if someone is still unemployed after they've exhausted their 26 weeks of benefits, they can get 13 more weeks for a total of 39 weeks. And those extra 13 weeks are available to workers who used up the 26 weeks anytime after July 1st, 2019. The State Department of Labor is supposed to be reaching out to them to notify them of that. So this could be a great boon for minimum wage workers who might take home about $440 a week, which is 40 hours a week at $11 an hour. With a regular UI and with a $600 supplement, they will have a little extra money for much needed costs related to the pandemic and to catch up on debts they've incurred. The second thing I want to talk about is the new federal program for other workers. So traditional UI left out a lot of workers, people who simply weren't eligible. Those were the self-employed, people in the gig economy, people seeking only part-time work, and people relatively new to the workforce who really hadn't built up an earnings record. There's a new federal program, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Act, or PUA. And those workers I just described can now get benefits that are comparable to traditional UI. They will get a minimum of $200 a week and a maximum of $649 a week, depending on their earnings in tax year 2019. And just like the traditional UI recipients, they can get 39 total weeks of benefits and the extra $600 a week. One of you asked a question about student eligibility. Students are often not regular for regular UI, especially if they're full-time students, but they may be eligible for this new PUA coverage, even if they're only available for part-time work. So there's one big difference between regular UI and this new PUA program. PUA is paid only to workers unable to work because of a reason directly related to COVID-19. So a self-employed worker who has no income for a reason unrelated to COVID-19 would not qualify for benefits under this program. The COVID-19 related reasons include a worker is diagnosed with the virus, has symptoms and is seeking a diagnosis, has been advised by a healthcare professional to self-quarantine, the worker is caring for someone with COVID-19, or is a primary caregiver for a child whose school or daycare is closed due to COVID-19. So the Connecticut Department of Labor announced yesterday that it will begin accepting claims for this PUA program on April 30th. The benefits can be retroactive to the date a worker needed to apply, and we're suggesting that workers gather proof of work and income from 2019 to see if they would qualify for more than the minimum $200 benefit. So they should collect their tax returns, their invoices, bank deposits, receipts, and 1099s. The last thing I'm going to talk about is the different UI processes. Many of you had questions about this. So our advice is that a worker should apply for unemployment as soon as work ends, file on that Sunday. Don't wait to make sure that they're eligible because they may not be paid for any week if they file a late claim. People apply by filing online at the Department of Labor website. Unfortunately, at this point, that is the only application route. The brick and mortar American job centers are closed, and the Department of Labor shut down its phone application line before the pandemic. Legal Services plans to do some advocacy to get other routes available of application because we understand that not everyone has a computer or a smartphone through which they can apply. Spanish applications are available on the DOL website. People need to be a little bit patient when they apply. It's a little bit of a tricky two-part process. They have to first set up benefit payments online, either direct deposit or a debit card if they haven't collected unemployment before, and they have to answer questions about eligibility. And there are basically two routes. The first one is expedited. So if someone was laid off or furloughed because of COVID-19, there is a relatively quick triage application with instructions about how to answer questions. But if the person is not working for other reasons, they'll need to answer questions on a regular application, and they may be sent a document called a claimant separation questionnaire to fill out. For those, the Department of Labor will review them to see if the person might be disqualified for willful misconduct or quitting without good cause. Some unemployment rules have temporarily changed. Ordinarily, a worker or a claimant must apply for at least 3 jobs a week to satisfy the work search requirement. During the duration of the pandemic, that is not required. No work search is required for the first 26 weeks. And then there is some work search likely required if the person goes on to the 13-week extension. So benefits, if for people who are eligible, should start to flow quickly, but meanwhile, there are people who've been waiting in the queue because they applied 5 or 6 weeks ago and bills have built up. And it's important to remember that there are protections available to those people who had no income during the gap. There's a moratorium on gas, electric, and water shutoffs through the duration of the public health emergency. And there's an automatic 60-day grace period for April's rent for renters. It will be due May 31st, and landlords can't impose any penalties like late fees. And there's a 60-day grace period for May's rent if the tenant asks for it. So that would be due June 30th, again, without penalties. And no eviction papers can be served until July 1st. So that's a bit of a reprieve while the unemployment system catches up. You will learn more, or you can learn more about the eviction foreclosure protections for tenants and homeowners at the next legal services briefing, which will be on housing. The date is to be decided, and you will all receive an invitation to attend that. So thank you all very much for listening into today's employment briefing. I hope you learned valuable information and that we answered some of your questions. And please stay safe. Thank you.